This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Intelligence Matters Podcast with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, sponsored by Raytheon.
I think being a conservative in the foreign policy world, you understand that all the hard decisions are 51-49 kinds of decisions when they're not indeed 50.1, 49.9, that you know the decision.
Oh, they wouldn't be on your desk.
They
right?
wouldn't be
Somebody
on your
else
desk.
Would have made them.
That it's a murky world, that you cannot fully foretell the consequences of what you're going to do, and you just have to live with that. To some extent, what Trump represents is a broader American disenchantment with the role that we've played in the world since 1945. The larger point to make here is there are certain ways in which actually he represents some continuity with the Obama administration. The kind of not only disappointment with, but dismissal of our European allies, the desire to really disengage almost completely from the Middle East, the unwillingness to really contribute to the building of alliances.
So if this doesn't change, if this goes on for some period of time, what does the world look like?
I think it's quite conceivable, absent some serious political leadership, that you could have a period where the United States is only erratically internationalist. There'll be more room for all kinds of states and non-state actors to first have their will in their local regions, as to some extent they are already doing. And they will also believe that they can get away with intervention in politics around the world in the kind of way that we saw in the last election and that we'll see in future. So I think you'll see more of that. And the result of that could be a more, I think, would be a more chaotic kind of world.
Dr. Elliot Cohn is the Executive Vice Dean, the Chief Operating Officer of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. He is the founder of the Strategic Studies Program there. From 2007 to 2009, Dr. Cohen served as counselor of the Department of State, advising Condoleezza Rice on the entire range of national security issues. Dr. Cohen has authored numerous books and articles, including a recent piece in Foreign Affairs titled America's Long Goodbye. I just had a chance to sit down with Dr. Cohen to discuss this very important article. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our exclusive sponsor, Raytheon. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
From end-to-end cybersecurity to high-energy lasers to quantum computers, Raytheon is there. Advancing technologies that protect people, information, and infrastructure. Raytheon, making the world a safer place.
Welcome to the show, Elliot. It's great to have you on Intelligence Matters, and it is always great to see you.
Well, it's great to be back together with you, Mike.
So you've had primarily an academic career, but you've had a number of touch points over the years with the U.S. national security community. The most prominent was your service as counselor to the Secretary of State, to Condoleezza Rice, during her tenure. And really two questions that come out of that for me. One is, what does a counselor to the Secretary of State do every day? And even more important, what was it like to work for Condi, who I
think is a remarkable person?
Well, the short answer to the first question, Mike, is you do whatever the secretary asks you to do. It's a very odd position. There's nothing like it in any other foreign ministry in the world because you're actually quite a senior official. You're an undersecretary level official, and therefore you can represent the department in all kinds of ways, including the deputies committee, which we both served on, which is where a lot of the high-level policy, the shaping of decisions gets made. And then she can deploy you wherever she likes. And because my background had mainly been in association with the United States military, I spent a lot of time on Iraq, Afghanistan. And then when we had crises blow up, like the North Korean nuclear reactor in Syria, she gave me that portfolio and others. So it was fascinating. Day to day, it was I would read an enormous amount of intelligence product. I would periodically, there were certain routine kinds of things I would do, particularly on the Iraq and Afghan accounts. And then I had a brief to look at things and then walk into her office and in all privacy say, "Boss, you're really not going to like what I'm about to tell you, but X." One of them was very much on the North Korean account saying, "Boss, I hate to tell you this, but I think the North Koreans are probably cheating on the plutonium declarations and they probably have a parallel nuclear program." I made at least one of my State Department colleagues very angry when I did that.
I remember that whole story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you folks were incredibly helpful on that one. But really valuable. And Condi, to kind of transition to your second question, she was great. I mean, I was paid to disagree with her, and I did, in private. She would be unhappy, of course, when I told her that something that really was not going to comport well with the policy that she wanted. But she would always hear you out. She wouldn't necessarily do what I wanted her to do. But, for example, when I went in and told her that and made a powerful case that Afghanistan was not going well, that was not what she wanted to hear. But she took it on board. And of course, this is somebody who just kind of lights up the room whenever she chooses to turn the charm on. The last thing I would say about her, and I think this is why she wanted somebody like me as counselor, she's a woman with many different pieces to her identity. One critical part is being an academic. And so often on overseas trips, we'd have dinner together on her plane, and actually what she wanted to talk about was academic gossip, So there was, and I think, the State Department is a pretty hierarchical place, and I think she wanted another professor to argue with. Mm-hmm. So that was my job.
Yeah, great. So, Elliot, you mentioned that you read a lot of intelligence, and I'm sure both analysis and then the raw human intelligence and the raw technical intelligence, and I'd be interested in how helpful you found that, and even more importantly, what would have made it more useful to you as you look back on it?
I did read a lot of intelligence, and I did read both finished intelligence and some of the raw intelligence, particularly signals intelligence, that kind of thing. I found that they were always useful in terms of providing context, but I was always craving other kinds of things as well. So I think it's very important for policymakers both to understand and respect what intelligence can provide you, but also understand what it can't. So, for example, I'll give you two cases where sources other than the intelligence community could provide me, if you will, better intelligence than the IC. The first was we had an absolutely terrific consul general in Peshawar, and she wrote these wonderful dispatches, these wonderful cables, as they call them in the State Department. And she was really well plugged into the power structure in that part of Pakistan, which was of critical importance to us. She knew the personalities. She had a wonderful feel for the politics. So if I wanted to know what was really going on in that part of the country, that's what I read. I would read reports by the International Crisis Group. Now, usually the last two pages were their policy recommendations, which were useless, so I'd rip those off and get rid of them. But they would have people on the ground. They could go places other people couldn't go, and they were very valuable. But having said all that, the American intelligence community produces a lot of wonderful material. My view is you have to immerse yourself in it. And then periodically, it's really important to be able to do a deep dive. And, of course, you helped me do that on a couple of occasions.
I remember when we did on North Korea, where you came over. I was the head of analysis at the agency at the time.
Yes.
And you wanted to get smart on North Korea because of what was happening. And you came over, and I think we spent a couple of hours in my conference room, and we had probably 10 analysts around the table.
Yeah.
And I remember as we were walking out, you said to me, you have a great job because you have access to all this expertise, right?
Yeah.
At any moment in time. And it was absolutely true.
Yeah, it really was. And there was one of the things I really respected about that was the ability to take quite technical knowledge. In that case, it was about whether the North Koreans were lying, which, of course, they were, about what they were up to. And that required some technical expertise. Be able to put it into something that I could understand without that kind of nuclear engineering background that that I needed. So that was great. And I will say I don't miss that feed. At first I did. I think a lot of people feel withdrawal. It turns out when you get off the intelligence feed, you have time to read other kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I thought I was going to miss it too, and I didn't.
Yeah.
And in fact, reading open sources and reading work by academics and think tanks can get you most of the way there. Get you most of the way there.
I very much agree with that.
Elliot, one more question before we jump into the meat of what I want to talk about, and that is, you are often described as a conservative, sometimes a neoconservative, although that term tends not to get used so much anymore. But what I'm really interested in is how you see the fundamental difference between a conservative foreign policy thinker and a liberal foreign policy thinker. What's the difference?
Yeah, I do think of myself as a conservative, which, as I tell people now, that's why I'm no longer a Republican. I think I'll give you just my feeling. And I don't like the term neoconservative. It meant something in the 1970s, and whenever I ask people what the apostolic creed of the neoconservatives is, they can never come up with a good definition.
It's just not meaningful anymore.
It's really not meaningful. I think what is it that a conservative foreign policy means and a conservative in general? Well, I would say a conservative in general is always aware that you can make things worse and that so therefore you should be careful. I think conservatives often tend to have a somewhat dark view of human nature and where it can take you, and so perhaps a deeper sensitivity to evil and
it's more skeptical of the adversaries as a result.
Yes, so I would say those kinds of things. I think that liberal foreign policy thinkers, I don't want to caricature them, I think, will frequently have more confidence in international institutions. I think they will be more confident that there are solutions to really hard problems. I'm not in favor of being passive, far from it, but I think I'm probably particularly sensitive to the idea that you're going to solve one problem that will give you then a different set of problems that you have to deal with. I think the thing that distinguishes, though, a conservative from somebody who says, look, just don't do anything, is an awareness that sometimes by doing nothing is a decision too, and it can make things worse. Maybe I would put it this way. I think being a conservative in the foreign policy world, you understand that all the hard decisions are 51, 49 kinds of decisions when they're not indeed 50.1, 49.9, that
the decision. They wouldn't be on your desk.
They
right?
wouldn't be
Somebody
on your desk.
Somebody else would have made them.
That it's a murky world, that you cannot fully foretell the consequences of what you're going to do, and you just have to live with that.
There's a perception that conservative foreign policy tends people more toward a military option. Is that your sense or not?
I don't think necessarily. I mean, there are some maybe who are. I think the way in which that might be true is that I think it'd be very hard for a conservative foreign policy thinker to say, well, force doesn't matter, military power doesn't matter. So I think they tend to weigh heavily the importance of military power in the conduct of foreign policy. But I think I would certainly say this for myself. I think a good conservative is also aware that, you know, you decide to use military force, then all kinds of other things are going to flow from that, many of which you cannot foretell.
And certainly in the Obama administration, I saw liberals argue for the use of military force and the conservatives argue against it.
Yes.
And Libya is the best example of that.
Yeah.
Where Secretary Clinton was pushing for military action and Bob Gates was, whoa.
Yeah.
Let's think this through, right? This is not a good idea.
Yeah. Of course, some of that I'm sure was influenced by Iraq, where you could make the reverse case that the conservatives were in favor and the liberals were pretty much in favor of it, too. It just that
everybody was. I think a lot of people have forgotten they were.
No, there's been a lot of rewriting of history there.
So, Elliot, what I really want to dig in on is an article that you recently published in Foreign Affairs titled America's Long Goodbye, The Real Crisis of the Trump Era. I think this is one of the most important pieces published in Foreign Affairs, which is an elite journal, in the last few years. I read it with great interest. I found myself agreeing throughout. I found my head bobbing up and down. Can you walk us through the argument in that piece? And I want to take some time here, so don't worry about how long you're taking.
Sure. Well, thank you, and thanks for the compliments. Well, I begin with the presidency of Donald Trump. And just so your listeners may be aware, I was from the outset very critical of candidate Trump and then of President Trump. I helped organize these two letters by Republican foreign policy experts that were severely critical of Trump during the campaign. And I don't think I've let up since in the column I write for The Atlantic. But what I begin the piece with is saying, look, you know, he hasn't caused the apocalypse. We haven't had World War III. We didn't have a war on the North Korean Peninsula. He hasn't done any of the really crazy stuff that people were afraid of, withdrawal from NATO, something like that. But, and this is really the thesis of it, is that there is this long-building crisis because, what the fundamental argument is that to some extent what Trump represents is a broader, not complete, but a broader American disenchantment with the role that we've played in the world since 1945. And basically, I then unpack it. So I begin by saying, okay, why didn't Trump do some of the crazy stuff that he was talking about? And there are a number of reasons. I think he's not, part of it is that he's not focused and disciplined enough to actually make the government work the way he would like to make it work. And as we both know, to get the government to do what you want to do is hard with a fantastic team and with a really switched on president. And that's not what they've got. I make the case further that he is actually in some ways risk averse and that you can even see that in a different way in his business career. You know, he preferred to go bankrupt with other people's money and debt. I argue then that the damage that he's done has really been in terms of the deterioration of long-term relationships, particularly with allies. But I think behind all that, and I would also say that some of his advisors, including I think the team they have now, Secretary of State Pompeo and National Security Advisor Bolton, are much more skilled than their predecessors were at manipulating the president. Mm-hmm. And I use the word manipulated advisedly. But I think the larger point to make here is there are certain ways in which actually he represents some continuity with the Obama administration, which will make friends of mine from that administration uncomfortable to hear. But I believe it's true. The kind of not only disappointment with but dismissal of our European allies, the desire to really disengage almost completely from the Middle East, the unwillingness to really contribute to the building of alliances. So, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Trump walked away from. Well, the truth is the Obama administration was not all that keen on it until the very end.
And you remember Secretary Clinton ran against it.
Yes, and exactly.
In the campaign.
Exactly. So I think to some extent he's representing a kind of broader sort of fatigue, which has a number of different sources. There's these broader set of attitudinal changes in the United States, which help provide some of the background for Trump and which make me think that the issues that we're confronting now will last some time.
Which makes both Obama and Trump not the actors, but reacting to something going on in the country.
Or manifestations of something going on in the country. And I have a complex view of the role of individuals in the making of history. They're both consequential individuals in different ways, but they are also, to some extent, consequential because they're reflecting some deeper forces and trends that are out there. I mean, they wouldn't be able to do nearly as much in opposition to those trends. So I'd say there are really three things at work. One is fatigue with what people sometimes call the forever wars, Iraq most notably, Afghanistan, the sense that, you know, we've been stuck in the Middle East forever and body bags coming home and what exactly has it bought us and so on. I think so that's one. Second, behind that and even larger is the American people bought off on a global role for the United States in the wake of the Cold War. Actually, they bought off on it starting at the end of World War II. And then in the 1990s and early 2000s, there was no public reconsideration of the policy that had given us a military in order of magnitude larger than we had ever had, and permanent alliances in peacetime and deployments overseas. I talk about this in my last book, The Big Stick, about the missing debate. And there's a number of reasons why that debate didn't happen, but it didn't happen. So in some ways, we're seeing the kinds of views that would have been represented earlier if people had wanted to talk about it at the end of the Cold War. And then I think the third thing, which I talk about in the article, is, you know, we are finally at the point where there is no living memory of the 1930s to speak of, and very soon there'll be no living memory of the Second World War. And what, you know, it's impossible to overstate the impact of World War II, and not just World War II, but the 1930s, on the sensibility of Americans throughout the Cold War. You know, every one of our Cold War presidents had some kind of connection to the Second World War. They all had learned some very profound lessons about what happens when the United States chooses not to be a major actor in shaping world order. I'm not talking about isolationism in the classic sense. I'm talking about the United States not thinking that only this country has the ability to really shape an international order. Well, that is no longer a living memory. And I think that's really important, and it's often underestimated how important that is.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, Raytheon, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Elliot Cohen.
Do you hear that? That's the sound of the world changing, of networks connecting, enemies evolving. You can't slow it down. You can't avoid it. You can't stop it. But you can stay a step ahead. Every day, Raytheon engineers are innovating, modernizing, delivering trusted, innovative solutions that protect people, information, and infrastructure. So as our world changes, we can make it a safer place.
So if this doesn't change, if this goes on for some period of time, what does the world look like? What's the impact of all of this?
So first, what the this is. I think that this, and I discuss this in the article, that this will be a United States that's sort of erratic. Trump will either lose in 2020 or he'll lose in 2024, or not lose, but he'll be succeeded, or he may get impeached along the way or something like that. But I suggest that you could have different varieties of America First, either of the left or even of the disenchanted center. So I think it's quite conceivable, absent some serious political leadership, that you could have a period where the United States is only erratically internationalist. Yeah, we sort of engage on Venezuela, but we're not really willing to really think through what would it mean if the Maduro government's overthrown and, you know, how do you stabilize that region? Or you'll have one-off kinds of deals here and there. And I think in a world like that, we won't be supplanted by a single power or even a coalition of powers. I don't think that's what's likely to happen. But there'll be more room for all kinds of states and non-state actors to first have their will in their local regions, as to some extent they are already doing.
Heading in that direction, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, it is stunning to me that here you have, I'll just give one example. You have China putting a very large percentage of its Uyghur population into concentration camps. We're talking hundreds of thousands of people. And there's not a squawk about it.
Nary a peep.
Nary a peep. So you'll have more. People can get away with stuff. They won't even be called out on it. You know, we won't call out the Saudis when they murder a journalist who is an American resident. But it'll get a lot worse than that. So they'll be asserting themselves in a variety of ways that will erode international norms. And they will also believe that they can get away with intervention in politics around the world in the kind of way that we saw in the last election and that we'll see in future. So I think you'll see more of that. And the result of that could be a more chaotic kind of world.
Is it a world in which there's a risk of conflict that
Much
would
high, yes.
draw us in, and so we would come full circle back to what we learned in World War II?
I think so, except the difference would be that it's a world in which the United States wouldn't have the enormous economic leverage or the same kind of economic leverage that it had. It would be a world with a lot of people with nuclear weapons and possibly with other weapons, which would be biological in nature, which would be able to deter us from doing things. You know, if Nazi Germany had a full-blown nuclear arsenal, can we be so sure that we would have gone into World War II the way we did? And, you know, and more broadly, I would say I have part of being a conservative. As I said, you have a dark view of human nature. The possibility for people screwing up and stumbling into a war that they don't really want, I think, gets much higher. You know, we may have avoided another Indo-Pakistani war. Who says it's guaranteed that we will always avoid that? You know, I'm basically an historian. And if there's one thing I think I've learned from history is human beings make all kinds of mistakes all the time.
Right. Most wars start that way.
Yep.
So when I travel around the country, Elliot, one of the things I hear from folks is if there's a national security threat that is absolutely clear, like ISIS or like North Koreans with nuclear weapons, they want their government to do something about it. But when it's much less clear, like Vladimir Putin messing around in eastern Ukraine or the Chinese dominating the South China Sea, they ask themselves, what does that have to do with me? Why should I care about that? And I'm wondering to what extent we as national security folks need to do a better job of articulating why that kind of stuff matters to the American people.
I think we do need to do a much better job, but it's a job not just for us, but for political leaders. And again, this is nothing particularly new. You know, if you look at what was the debate last time we had America First, which was shortly before World War II, there were arguments that people were making. You know, the Versailles Peace Treaty was unfair to Germany, or look at British and French behavior in their colonies. Are you really telling me that they're any better and Europe is really far away? What difference does it make to us? Part of the difference then is you had as president a very adroit politician, Franklin Roosevelt, who understood that you had to make a case in a way that people who do not focus on foreign policy, who are smart but don't pay a lot of attention to it, can understand. And I think one consequence of the Cold War and then of that period in the 1990s when everything was going our way so it wasn't important, and then the 2000s when you had the crisis of 9/11, is politicians, particularly presidents, got out of the habit of talking to the American people about the American role in the world, what we should do, what we have to do, what the consequences are if we don't do things. I don't think they've thought of it as part of the job description. And I regret to say that I don't see a whole lot of that either these days in Congress. You know, I was pretty close to John McCain. I think John McCain understood that that was part of his job. You know, it was to make the case for why the United States needs to be engaged. And there was a generation of congressional leaders who came out of World War II who also felt that way.
You actually talk in your article about John's passing and what that means for where we are. Maybe the last individual in the Hill who really understood what we're talking about.
Yeah, and somebody who understood that the Senate has a particularly important role to play in terms of exercising leadership. You know, McCain would go to all the hard places. He'd put himself in harm's way. But he understood he was representing the United States. And he also understood the importance of being there, seeing for himself, and then coming back and talking to people back home, whether everybody from the president to his constituents in Arizona. And I thought we had more people who could do that anywhere near as well as he could. Now, that's, you know, we just had a large congressional delegation go to the annual Munich Security Conference. I think that was a good thing. I think they wanted to send a message to our European allies that the United States is not just walking off the stage. And the great strength of this country is we can grow new political elites. We are better at that than anybody else in the world. But it all comes down to leadership.
Is there a particular moment when you think we began this shift away from traditional American leadership in the world to this new world that you're describing? Is this a result of the aftermath and politics of the Iraq War? Is there a particular moment, or is it more long term?
You know, it's very hard to tell close to the events, and having taken part in a marginal way in some of them, I'm a good enough historian to know that I'm a terrible judge of that. I think you could see some of the seeds of this in the immediate post-Cold War period. But I do think as Iraq went sour, what it did was it was partly the cause, but more that it activated lots of doubts that people already had. You know, that's how I think politics often works. That it's not that somebody says something you've never thought of before, but that you ideas that were kind of inchoate and in the back of your mind that you didn't really express and you knew other people didn't agree with them, so you wouldn't put them out there. Now all of a sudden it's okay to lay them out on the table and to put them pretty forcefully. And there are politicians who are saying the kinds of things that you've always had this kind of uneasy feeling about. And that, I do think Iraq was the trigger in many ways for ideas that have been there for a long time. You know, Dwight D. Eisenhower had to fight a really big battle with Robert Taft over NATO. So these views have been out there forever.
And in some ways, this period of American leadership in the world is an aberration in our history.
It is, in some ways, an aberration.
We spent a little time up front talking about North Korea, and I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about it. I just want to get your sense of what's going on today. How do you think about the Singapore summit and the Hanoi summit and where we are and where we might be going?
So you know, we're all colored by our own experience. So the first thought I had was, boy, I've seen this movie before. You know, I was in the Bush administration.
Played in this movie before.
I played in this movie before. I was a bit of a spoiler in it. You know, I remember when they blew up the smokestack at Yongbyon and the assistant secretary of state was running our negotiations with them, was ecstatic. This is the end. Of course, your people said, no, actually, they can rebuild the smokestack. And I vividly remember when I told Condi, you know, they're cheating on their declarations. And the circumstantial evidence is really good that they have a parallel program to enrich uranium. So this assistant secretary comes into my office and he says, counselor, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to fling open a steel blast door and there's going to be a room full of spinning centrifuges. A year later, actually, Sig Hecker, who you know well from the Los Alamos National Laboratory, went there. They flung open a steel blast
door. They showed him those centrifuges.
And there was a room full of spinning centrifuges. So this is not the first time that American policymakers have deceived themselves into thinking that there's a deal. First thought. Second thought, you never send a president to a summit unless it's just to sign the deal and have a great ceremony or maybe to close the last 2-5%. These folks decide, or the president, I think, decided it's okay to have him make the deal there. And that, I think, is really pretty crazy. Third thing, I think, is one of the ways in which Trump is a problematic foreign policy president, it's pretty easy to figure out how to manipulate him. And the North Koreans are good at that. And so that even when that this thing collapses, you know, they've got him in a place where he's saying that, no, I don't think that they knew that this young man, Mr. Warmbier, had been essentially murdered by them.
Right.
You know.
So you're painting a pretty dire picture of the future here. And I'm wondering if there was one thing that we could do to make a difference here, what that might be.
You know, I mean, I am a glass half empty kind of guy.
So am I.
Well, you're an intelligence officer, for goodness sakes. You're supposed to do. It's you smell flowers, you look for the funeral. Look, I think the most, I am a long-term optimist about the United States. I think it's the most resilient country on earth. I think the most important thing, and this is a good thing, which this era is producing, is for people to get involved in politics. And whether, some of the people we both know who've run for office, people like Tom Malinowski, I was delighted to see him run for office. I was delighted to see on the other side somebody who I knew as a graduate student, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, run and win as a representative. The challenge is to get engaged. And the main thing I would tell your audience is, you know, we've had it really easy, our generation. When I think about what my parents and what my grandparents lived through, the Great Depression, World War II, McCarthy, Korea, you know, cities up in flames, the struggle for civil rights, Vietnam, and that's just my parents. My grandparents lived through the First World War and the influenza epidemic. I mean, who says we have it easy, you know?
Elliot, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Elliot Cohen. I'm Michael Morell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
This has been the Intelligence Matters podcast with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, sponsored by Raytheon. The podcast is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, and Claire Himes. If you haven't already, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you download podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Intel Matters Pod and follow Michael at Michael J. Morell. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News Radio.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.